Welcome to our Agile Tales, where we share the various successes and trials we've encountered as we navigate corporate levels and political waters to transform the business to be adaptable to this forever changing world.
We are glad you could join us today as we embark on a new series with Evan Leyburn, founder of the Business Agility Institute, or BAI. BAI is an international membership body that champions and supports next-generation organizations that are agile, innovative, and dynamic. These are the right organizations needed to thrive in today's unpredictable and constantly changing markets. Evan is the author of the book, Directing Agile Organization, and the book, #NoProjects, A Culture of Continuous Value. Let's all welcome Evan Leyburn to our Agile Tales as we chat about change is the only constant.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for agreeing to come onto our podcast, Our Agile Tales. Before we start, we want to get to know you a little bit. Hope that is okay.
Of course.
I know you've been many things throughout your career. You said a satellite engineer, a library assistant, a koala, a business intelligence developer, and a manager, amongst others. Now, you said that being a satellite engineer is not what it sounds like. So what do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, thank you for having the conversation. I love chatting with the two of you. You're some of my favorite folk in America. So any opportunity to chat is I will always have. Yeah, so there are times when job descriptions and job titles are completely misaligned. So I moved out of home when I was 16, and I had a whole bunch of like odd jobs, as you say, koala, library, and so forth. But I was doing a computer science degree, and so obviously I wanted some kind of work that was in like working with computers. So I think it was in like second year, there was this an organization that did satellite television for rural Australia. So like cable, but satellite. And so it was shift work. And of course, like I'm doing full-time uni, so my work has to fit around uni. So shift work was good. And I have to admit the midnight to 8 a.m. shift was rough. But yeah, it's my job for 2+ years throughout university was to monitor the feeds from the satellite. I had these banks of about, 100, 120 televisions with all the channels. And my job was to make sure that anyone watching at 3 o'clock in the morning still got their television. And if things went wrong, then I had a list of scripts that I could sort of follow to try and fix things. And then obviously people to escalate to if things really went wrong. And yeah, otherwise I spent like most shifts, it was 8 hours of unlimited TV, but nothing to watch.
Oh dear. Wow, that's definitely different. Now, you mentioned koala. So the inquiring minds wants to know about your koala story. What do you koala?
This was my very first job. So in Australia, you can work as early as 14 and 9 months. So 14 and 9 months, almost to the day. I was at a market, like any kind of market, like a social, like not like a big formal, like professional market, but just like mums and dads and people selling stuff. And it's out of the back of a school kind of thing. So a very informal, very local community kind of market. And there's this lady or gent, I don't remember, dressed up in a koala suit with a bucket, right, asking for donations for the Wilderness Society. They had this little thing. It's like looking for koalas. And it's like, well, I'm 14 and 9 months and I like the Wilderness Society. I love what they're doing. So yeah, why not? Let's volunteer. And I literally spent, I don't know, a year and a half thereabouts until I was about 16, 17, dressing up in a koala costume, which was really hot in an Australian summer, and hopping on a, like going from like the Wilderness Society in Glebe and hopping on a train to like Central or Town Hall or to one of the big touristy places like Darling Harbour, and doing a song and dance for 2 or 3 hours and soliciting donations from people, annoying residents, entertaining tourists, definitely annoying the residents. And yeah, so I dance around Chinatown or Town Hall or somewhere like that. And at the end of my shift, I'd come in and just hand the bucket of money back. And that was my job. That was my very first job.
Wow. Well, for our listeners, Evan actually have shown me a picture of him dressing up in the koala suit. And I'm sorry, you won't get to see it, but it is funny. So does being a satellite engineer, a library assistant, a koala, and a BI developer shape you in how you are as a manager? And do any of those roles lead you to business agility?
So I think everything shapes us, and I don't think it shapes us in ways that we expect. So being a satellite engineer, that job I don't think shaped me, but doing shift work, working from either, like, there were days when I would work from 4 to midnight, then it's like I'd be on again the next 4 to midnight. Then there are days I'd be on from like midnight to 8 a.m. I'd go to university, I'd have another midnight to 8 a.m. shift, but I'm so wired from uni and everything else that I can't go to sleep. And so I'm up until nearly midnight, then I've got my midnight to 8 a.m. shift, and then I've got university again. So it's like a bloody 36 hours before I'm actually sleeping. And whilst we know that, and I'm not saying that that kind of like lack of sleep, this was more like I'm like 20, 21, something like this. It's like I've got energy. A 20-year-old can stay up 36 hours without too much problems. But what it taught me just as an individual was dedication, and I'll say stubbornness, but not stubbornness in a bad way, but that bullheaded ability to go, I've got to do something and I'm going to do it. Right? I'm tired. I don't want to go to my uni lecture. Hell, I want to fall asleep on this chair because it's 6 o'clock in the morning. I haven't slept for over a day. But if I do and something goes wrong, then, well, that's me. And so like my goal is always to serve. My goal is to do the best job I can and to help others. And whether that's literally just doing the job I'm paid for. And so that bullheadedness, that ability just to focus and go get it done, in spite of the fact that your body's saying, yeah, you probably need to sleep. But the other thing that that kind of job taught me was to listen to your body. Because there are days when it's just like, I've got to call in sick because if I don't sleep properly, I will get sick. I will, like, something bad will happen. And so I'd call my backups, like, hey, can you take the shift tonight? Sure. And of course, they would do the same for me. So I'd take their shifts as needed. But it taught me to know, to respect my limits, know when I can go beyond them, for how long I can go beyond them, but then, of course, how to come back and just rebuild that physical, mental, emotional resilience required to just work at that limit and that bullheaded, this is what I need to do, and I will move heaven and hell to make sure that gets done. Because not because it's important that people get television, but because it's important to me to do what I said I was going to do. And that was definitely something that I learned with the koala, right? Dressing up as a koala. Again, I'm 14, I'm 15, I'm 16. Like I'm very impressionable. I'm learning many things, certainly. And I certainly learned how to dance in 35 degrees Celsius. Was that 100 Fahrenheit weather in a furry koala costume? I'm not sure that's a life lesson that I'm really able to apply anywhere else in my life right now. Though I have to admit, I do have a 9-year-old daughter. So maybe I am applying that lesson more than I would perhaps otherwise have expected. But even being a koala, having, again, it's a service role. It's sure, like I'm paid. It is a job. I'm not paid much. It's a charity, but it's a job with a mission. I'm achieving something valuable. And so when I come back with $100 in coins, Australia doesn't have $1 notes. So it's like all the donations, like $1, $2, and they're all coins. So that bucket got heavy. But again, it taught me the importance of having a mission, having a vision in the work that you do, even if it is just dancing in a furry koala costume for 3 hours, entertaining tourists. Each role teaches something. By the time I sort of graduated and sort of got involved in business intelligence, data warehousing, this is before big data was a thing. This is back in the early 2000s, 2000, 2001, 2002. There, I'm learning more business skills. I'm learning more about the importance of data, the importance of how to make decisions. So there's a lot of things I'm learning there, but they're more it's much easier for me, I think, to look at that part of my life and say, today, I literally had to do a report on the ticket sales for our Business Agility Conference in March. And I know how to do that because I know enough statistics and enough modeling to be able to create like forecasts and reports and all that kind of stuff. And so I use that because those are tangible skills. But I think it's those, and I don't want to call them soft skills. What is it that are durable skills, I think. One of our members is an education organization, an education not-for-profit called America Succeeds. And they put out a report and they focus on K-12. And they put out a report on developing durable skills in students. So I like the word durable skills. But it's those early jobs which I didn't learn something that I can literally apply. Knowing how to dance in a costume and ask for money from tourists doesn't help me in my day job running the Business Agility Institute. But the durable skills and the mindset growth, that I think has impacted me more than the years that I spent doing business intelligence and any of that. Sorry, I know that was a very short question and I've been rambling for, I don't know, 10 or 12 minutes. So I hope that all made sense.
No, it's actually great. You're absolutely right. Everything that we do shapes us. So let's get into management a little bit, because we all know that most managers lack training, like you, because people think if you're good at X, then you must be good at managing X. But management is a totally different skill set. So in your opinion, what are the basic skills for managers?
So I really hope the people listening to this podcast actually heard my talk at the meetup. Otherwise, they're going to be really confused about why I'm a bad manager. Or rather, why I have no management training. For anyone who didn't listen, the first time I became an executive, and this is back in about 2008 when I became a director, I received no training. I didn't know how to be a director. I thought because I was good at business intelligence and project management, that I'd be a good director of business intelligence. But the skill sets required are like what I was director of, honestly, was almost irrelevant. The fact that I was good at X had very little bearing into my ability to be successful and ability to be good at leading X. In my case, that was business intelligence. This is before I really got involved this is actually the transition point where I've been using Agile. And so this is the transition point into what I now think of as business agility in my own personal experiences. But that's not actually answering your question. I very neatly avoided it. To answer your question, there are, I think, a number of key skills necessary for managers. And these are things that I think most people don't learn before they become leaders. Now, they should. Right? We should invest time in learning these, but we don't. So off the top of my head, the first one would be the skill of delegation. And I don't mean delegating work. I don't mean going, JF, I need this report done by Friday. Right? That's a skill too, but I'm really more talking about delegating outcomes, where it's JF, we've got a major client and we need to pitch to them on Friday. How would you close the sale? Or how would you do whatever it is? And maybe it's, I will create a report and we will present the report on Friday. But maybe you have an idea, a way that is, because you're closer to the client, because you're closer to the customer, you know who they are, how they respond. Maybe they hate reports. Maybe they don't read them. You know this. I don't, because I'm too far removed. Right? So if I know how to delegate outcomes, it gives you autonomy. It gives you the ability to achieve that outcome in the way that you see best. And especially given that you're the one closest to the customer, theoretically, you should have that ability. Now, the flip side of that is you can be wrong and you can make mistakes, and that's okay as well. And so another skill for a leader is that ability to support and develop people. Right? So people development. I talk about it as being the role of a manager is to help their people to be the best possible version of themselves. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to teach you how to write reports better. It goes back to these durable skills. My role is to develop you into someone who can think, who is adaptable, who has resilience. My role is to develop these capacity in you as well as the skills. And once, I suppose, you've as you grow and as you develop, my job is to say goodbye. Howard Sublett, who was the CEO of Scrum Alliance until recently, said to me once, a company is a parade of people. And I love that phrase because it does represent that impermanence. And so as a manager, my job is to develop you to be the best so that you can move on. Another key skill that leaders need to develop is that of communicating vision. Now, that's a very, it's a broad topic, but it covers things like storytelling. I can't inspire you by saying our metrics for the quarter are to achieve a 3% year-on-year improvement on widget sales. Great. You now have a KPI, but you're not exactly motivated. You're not exactly aligned to a vision. As a manager, I need to learn how to tell a story, how to show what we're working for. And sure, not every organization is there saving the world. Not every organization is the Wilderness Society. But even if your mission is to increase profit for, you work for a hedge fund, and your mission is to increase the profit of the account holders, a good manager can, there's inspiration in that. There is a vision. What are we trying to achieve and why? And so that's a skill, that developing that or communicating that vision. I'll say lastly, and I could go on forever, but I'll give you one more. And that is the skill of, I'll call it emergent strategy or adaptive strategy or strategic agility, pick your phrase. And we saw this a lot in the early days of COVID-19. Those managers and those organizations that had learned or invested in this creating adaptive emergent strategies responded better and faster. They knew how to make strategic decisions with insufficient information. They knew how to make strategic decisions that had feedback loops built in automatically so that when a new decision had to be made, and of course, in the midst of the emerging days of a crisis, of course, you're making decisions because the information is changing. But if you know how to create that emergent strategy and have and design these hooks in, then the decision you make tomorrow learns from the decision that you made yesterday, has that integrated hook. Whereas people who are used to building a 3-year strategic plan, the decision they make today is tactical, it's not strategic. And even if it is strategic, the decision you make tomorrow is disconnected from the one that you had yesterday because your strategy, you don't know how to build that adaptive emergent strategy. And so very tactically, leaders need to learn strategic agility. And these are skills that can be learned before you're a manager. These are skills that can be learned on the job. But I'll be blunt, most organizations don't invest enough in developing these skills. And that's kind of the problem.
Indeed. I'm just curious, what would you consider a good manager based on all the skills that you mentioned earlier? So what would be a good manager in your definition?
So I'm going to give you someone else's definition. W. Edward Deming. I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't remember the quote off the top of my head. A bad manager is someone who interferes where everything is normal and is absent when it's not. And so, and of course, this is Deming. He's writing in the 70s and 80s. It's about lean, the Japanese miracle. And so for him, it's about you've got a process and you've got your statistical run charts and you've got your upper control limits and lower control limits. And his idea of a good manager is there is variation in process, right? But if it's within the UCL, the upper control limit, and the LCL, the lower control limit, then a manager should just hands off and just let the team work, let the process flow. If there are impediments or blockers, if there are issues in the system, a manager's job is then to step in and to help and support and enable. Now, for Deming, we're talking manufacturing, it was more like the manager fixes the problem. So let's take less lean, more agile. The team can fix the problem, but the manager's job is there to remove impediments and make it possible for that problem to be fixed and to contribute. Hey, I've got an idea. So I'll go back to the 70s, the 80s, and what Deming said. A good manager is someone who is there to help when things are going wrong and isn't interfering when things are going absolutely fine.
Sounds good. I like that. Now, since we mentioned that managers aren't really trained by companies, how do you interview and evaluate good managers when you're building out your organization?
Oh, that's a very good question. I'm going to go back like several careers and just talk more generally in terms of how I've done it in the past. In the first instance, you want to actually try and develop leadership training in your organization. So if you are in an executive leadership role, then hopefully you're actually in a position to make some of these changes so the problem doesn't just keep snowballing. But let's say that, okay, you don't have that. Someone joins and they don't have that training. Right? Someone joins and like the very first job I had, I was very good at X. I wasn't good at leading X. There were two problems with this. Again, for those of you who heard the meetup, I'll repeat myself slightly. But I got the job primarily because, well, for two reasons. One, I knew how to do the underlying job, business intelligence. I could talk project plans. I could talk design. I could talk the work. But I got the executive role because I was confident. And I have learned in the intervening, 14, 15 years, save us from confident middle-aged white men. I was definitely a young white man then, but I think the principle still applies. I was confident and the interview panel, this was a government job, so it's all panel interviews. And the panel thought, hey, Evan is the right guy for the job. Let's give it to him. And I got it. And I wasn't the right person for the job. The thing is, I didn't even realize I wasn't. It's the sixth sense. I see dead people, but they don't know that they're dead. And I'm really sorry for anyone who hasn't watched the movie. But I think we've passed the limit of spoilers on that movie by this point. But it's like, I see bad managers, but they don't know they're bad managers. I was exactly the same. It took a good manager above me to point that out. So again, I've learned. So I have been in positions where I've then hired managers after I've learned a lot of this stuff. And I try and look beyond the confidence. Humans, very naturally, we are attracted to confidence. Now, whether that's in seeking a mate, whether that's seeking an employee, that is a very natural human condition. So we need to push beyond that. And I described in the meetup that early on, when I realized that I was a bad manager, I did some introspection and I started thinking about what it was that would make me successful. And I defined three characteristics: confidence, empathy, and competence or skill. And I had confidence. Empathy I had, but I'll be honest, I was compensating for the lack of skill, the lack of competence at the role with an excessive expression of authority. So whilst I had empathy, it was hidden. And in fact, it was my boss. He didn't actually point out that I didn't have the skill. He pointed out I didn't have the empathy. He called me arrogant. And that hit me because it's like, arrogant is not part of my mental model of myself. I was acting arrogant. And when that hit me, that was that moment of, well, I'd better do something about this. It wasn't as fast as that. It definitely took several months to process and create that growth mindset, but that's what it was. So in hiring, I'm trying to look beyond the confidence, but the two things I want to look for are empathy and skill, competence. And that competence is not competence at the underlying work, but competence in those management skills that I spoke about earlier. Now, which skills, to what degree, depends on the role, depends on the impact, depends on the candidates that we have available. But empathy, that doesn't depend on anything. You've got to have it. Right? There's no one version of empathy is better than the other. Like skills, sure. Like skill A or skill B, both is good, but I'll decide if I got one candidate with skill A and one candidate with skill B, then I'll decide based on which skill is most needed in that team. But empathy is empathy. It's a single cohesive unit. And I want to see, and I'll ask questions through interviews that will help build out, or sorry, pull out their expressions of empathy and how they work with others, how they see their relationship to others, all that kind of thing. So competence and empathy in addition to confidence.
That's it for our episode. Thank you for spending some time with us. Please join us next time as we continue our conversation with Evan Leyburn on Change is the Only Constant.
Thank you so much for listening to our Agile Tales. Feel free to ping us on ouragiletales.com.